for little risk. Send lawyers, guns, and money. Dad, get me out of this. Ha!
Welcome, everybody, to episode 76 of the Matt Jones Podcast. I realize that I've been saying one number behind what they have been for the last few, so I'm catching up. So if you're just listening straight, you'd be like, oh, there was no 75. That's because I actually screwed up. But nevertheless, it's the seventh since we restarted this, and I'm happy to be joined by someone that's become a very good friend of mine. He is a college basketball writer for ESPN. He's also the co-host with me of the Sunday morning NFL Countdown to Kickoff show on ESPN Radio, Myron Metcalf. Myron also, by the way, lives in Minnesota, so he's got a lot of stuff going on. Myron, how are you?
I'm good, man. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. I want to get to all the Minnesota stuff in a minute, but let's just start with this. So years ago, you were doing college basketball, and I knew you kind of on the periphery, didn't really know you. I mean, we'd talk occasionally if we saw each other or whatever. But I think, like, we weren't like friends.
Yeah.
And I do think that you were part of the collective college basketball media group that sort of thought I was a spawn of Satan. And first of all, am I right in that? And secondly, when you found out you were going to be doing this show with me, what was your thought on that?
I didn't think you were a spawn of Satan. I just knew, you know, if there's one name I knew before my first trip to Lexington, it was Matt Jones. You know, everybody talking about Matt Jones. The good thing is I came from the local level, right? So I was a local guy in Minneapolis, and then I became a national reporter. So, like, I didn't know much, you know. I was sort of green. But, yeah, man, but then we got to know each other. And
I don't think okay, so people who know, who listen to me know, like, I went through a period of time where I just sort of was middle fingers up and punching everyone on earth that I thought was had any importance, which is not the way to build a career, but it's what I did. But I don't feel like I did that to you, did I? Or no. Am I mistaken?
No, I don't think we ever had any like run-in moments like that. I remember we had like a fiery debate about something before a game. I don't remember what it was, but I think you were like sitting at those, you know, the pregame at Kentucky, everybody sitting at those like white tables.
Yeah.
I remember us like the pregame meal having some sort of conversation that was like, it was nothing, but we made it into more than it should have been.
You know, back in the day, that used to be an awesome place for people who don't know. Backstage, they'd have these tables, and during pregame dinner, like media dinner, everybody would sit there, and that's how I got to know almost everyone in the business, because everybody would sit there. Well, now it's changed. You have to go upstairs and get your food, and so people don't do it anymore. But that was really – there was a time you could look, especially when Cal was rolling those first couple years and we were the story, like all these national people would be like, there'd be Wilbon sitting right there, and you're like, what's going on, you know? That was a cool time.
Yeah, I think I spent – I don't know if anybody went to more Kentucky games as a national reporter than I did for that 2015 team. Like, I was there twice in the summer, and then the preseason, I went to a bunch of regular season games, and then I followed them from the SEC tournament all the way through, you know. So
did you like those guys? Did you like that group of dudes? I love those guys. Did you like them?
I mean, as a reporter, the benefit of Kentucky is that it's very NBA-like. So, like, they bring out the players, you get that access, you get someone who always gives you a story. So, like, as a reporter, you know it's going to be interesting. You're going to have a story to tell. So, I mean, I always love
dealing with a good group of talkers. That was a good group. I mean, Willie was a great talker. Carl Towns was a great talker.
Carl was great. Carl, I remember, he had, like, an alter ego. And like, they beat Florida. And Carl didn't feel like he played well. And he was talking about, I think Carlito was like his alter ego.
I forgot about Carlito.
He was so mad about, like, Carlito. He was talking about it. We were all like, wait, what is this dude talking about, man?
Well, Carl's weird. I mean, like, and you know, I guess you deal with him now in Minnesota. Yeah. Like, he's a weird dude. I mean, people listen to this know this story, but long story short, Kentucky went to the Bahamas before that season. The entire team. One day they had a day off, and they were all at this really nice pool hanging out. Yeah. And a dude bought a round of drinks for the whole team, which most people weren't 21, but in the Bahamas, you have to be 18, Myron. So it's okay, right? So there, so everybody's like about to take a shot for the team, and Carl doesn't drink. And remember, now Carl's brand new, like he's just gotten there, and he takes a shot glass of and like doesn't put anything in it. And when the team takes a shot, he takes a shot of air. And I was like, Carl, what are you doing? And he was like, I just don't want to miss time with my brothers, so I'll just drink air. And like, and he had, so like, as the team takes shots, Carl takes shots of air. And I always feel like that's a good description kind of who he is.
I think that's a perfect way to describe Carl Anthony Towns, man. I could definitely see that. He was super young too, right? Like he
was, wasn't even, he had just turned 18.
Yeah, man. That dude was, he's an interesting guy, man. Hell of a player too. But yeah, covering that team. That was fun. That was a fun ride.
Well, let's talk about Minnesota. So you live in Minneapolis. How long you live there?
So I came up, went to college, Minnesota State, Mankato, where the Vikings have their training camp. So I've been there since 05. So 15 years, I've been here. And, it's a small, big town. It's not very spread out. Like, even if you live outside of the city, everything's so centralized. And it's just one of those places where you legitimately, you know everybody. I mean, I see people at the rallies and protests. So I'm like, oh, I know that guy. I know that. I know exactly where that is, you know. So, it's really touched a lot of people. It's kind of everything.
Well, talk to me about that it's so weird when a national or international story descends on a community. I mean, it wasn't a controversy, but when Muhammad Ali died, the whole world descended on Louisville. Yeah. And when that happens, sort of the local part of it inevitably is going to get screwed up. I mean, it's just going to happen because, like, you can't know the intricacies of the city. You're there. Tell me the George Floyd stuff through the eyes of a person who's lived there and who knows the history in the way, for instance, I know the history of Louisville for the Breonna Taylor situation. What is that like there in Minneapolis?
So when I saw the video, and I think I saw it on Facebook first, I knew right away, like I knew this thing was gonna explode. And I knew that because I remember the emotions around Philando Castile, who a couple years ago died. Officer killed him, said he was reaching for his gun. Now that happened just outside Minneapolis. That was in a place called St. Anthony. So yes, Minneapolis, but not the Minneapolis police. And I remember thinking when that happened, if this had been the Minneapolis police, everything would have went crazy. So when I saw the George Floyd video and just how long it took and just the fact that people are pleading with him to stop, like I knew this whole city was going to be on fire. And that's exactly what happened. And
did you really know that? Let me yes. stop you there, because Minneapolis has never struck me as a on fire city, right? You always think of I didn't think of Minneapolis like that, but you sort of knew that tension was there.
I think Philando opened a lot of people's eyes in the reaction to that. I mean, that was a gigantic deal here. I mean, that was something that, and really kind of introduced we're showing you things happening in real time. I mean, they were live streaming what happened to Philando. So I think to see it again, there was a group of people who were already enraged from that. And then the officer in the Philando case gets off, you know, doesn't get any jail time. So there was already sort of this energy where people were upset. So when I saw where it was, I knew exactly the intersection. I knew exactly what that intersection was all about. And that's one of those intersections in Minneapolis where, like, you make a right turn here and you got a couple of $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 houses. You make a left turn here and you might be in the projects. You might have some public housing. You know, like, it's just one of those intersections that touches kind of everybody. Mm. So I knew where it was. I knew based on the video that it was going viral, that this was not going to be Philando. This was going to be what would have happened if Philando had been killed by a Minneapolis police officer. So I was bracing for it, to be honest. I was kind of bracing for what I felt like was coming.
You know, in the 60s and 70s, and maybe even up through the Rodney King riots, we saw videos and pictures. I mean, I wasn't alive for a lot of that, of cities burning. But really, even in the last 25 years, there have been protests, there have been issues, there have been all this, but we haven't seen burning. And then, like, I'm not sure. Okay, the George Floyd video is the most powerful video I've seen in years. Mm-hmm. Maybe second was the video of the police department catching on fire and the police running, like, driving away. Like, I'm actually surprised that video hasn't gotten more attention because it was so astounding to see the police running away, and understandably so, but running away from the police department. Give people a sense how much of Minneapolis burned. I think as the protest went elsewhere, Minneapolis stopped being the focus. So how much of this town was really destroyed?
What I think the national outlets missed was how widespread everything was, right? So east of Minneapolis, you had more than 300 buildings, businesses damaged or destroyed. The city, you're talking hundreds and hundreds. You're talking a six-story apartment building burned to the ground. You're talking a strip mall that everybody goes to, gone, cafes, liquor stores. I mean, it was literally like, I don't know what it's like to be in a situation where something is bombed, but that's what it felt like. Like, you saw something look a certain way today, and then tomorrow it's just something you don't even recognize. But I think people missed how widespread. Now, what also happened with some of the looting was the police were centralized. Like, this isn't some huge city, right? So all the police are rushing in to deal with everything happening in the city. So around the city, you've got pockets of situations where people are trying to deal with that, whether it's people setting things on fire, looting that's happening outside the city. So it honestly was chaotic for everybody. You're driving around and there are people who have "we'll shoot looter" signs. You know, these are places you went to go get a sandwich a few days ago and they've got armed guys outside, "we'll shoot any looter" sign. Like, it just, it honestly felt like you were in a movie set to some degree, man.
Is it, you tell me if I'm wrong, but it was almost a good thing for Minneapolis that protests started elsewhere, because I thought we were going to have a situation where the whole country descended on Minneapolis. It felt like for a day or two to me that, like, everyone that this was a cause to was all going to come there. And then that one night it ended up in other places and it was like, oh, this is just going to be everywhere, which is actually probably better. But I thought you were going to have a situation where the whole country came to Minneapolis, sort of like it did with Ferguson. Yeah. And if that happened, especially with the violence that had already occurred, I was really worried. Like, we're talking Thursday, Friday, Saturday, that little period. You and I talked, I believe, on Saturday. I was really like, what's going to happen? Did you feel scared at all living there?
Yeah, I mean, at what point, you know, with my daughters, three daughters, I was having a conversation of, do I take them in Milwaukee, where I'm from? My grandma.
Really? You thought about that? You thought about that?
Yeah, it was like, do we go to grandma's house for the next however long kind of thing, right? You know, just to get away. Because nationally, there was that energy. Is everybody going to descend upon the city? Here, though, it was, are people coming into the city just to start trouble? Are people coming into the city, you know, just to create more chaos? And there was like a really strong vibe of like people driving down the street and they see a car with no license plates and just like weird behavior that you never really thought of. And in the moment, there was a lot of misinformation. And I think the biggest thing, like, suddenly there was just like sort of a lack of trust of everybody. Mm-hmm. Like, you didn't know, you know, is your neighbor good? Is he cool? Is he somebody who maybe is burning down some of these buildings at night? You know, are people arming themselves? I mean, it honestly felt like an unstable city. And I thought it would get even worse. When they burned down the apartment building in the precinct, I was like, they're going to keep going. You know, they're going to keep going. And then it seemed like it wouldn't end. You know, so I certainly
it almost just kind of fizzled one night. And I'm glad, but it almost was like just one night there wasn't violence as much. And then it sort of fizzled. And then the nation's attention started going to everywhere else.
Yeah.
Which you probably were relieved with, I would think. Right.
Well, they brought in the National Guard. I mean, that's what changed, is when they brought in the National Guard and they brought in, I mean, literally you're driving your car, man, and there are lines of white vans full of officers. Like, you're seeing officers in vans four rows deep, and there's a line of them on the highway. The National Guard, I mean, these military helicopters. It became pretty clear by like Thursday that they were calling in everybody they could to get a handle on things. And I think they scared a lot of people, you know. But I think the other thing that changed was Friday, when the charges were brought against the officer, the main officer who had kneeled on George Floyd's neck, Derek Chauvin, I think that maybe got some people to say, okay, there's some progress here.
Yeah, that shouldn't have taken as long. I mean, no. Now, just on a personal level, as a lawyer, I've tried to look at the four people's culpabilities, not from a moral perspective. I think they're all culpable morally, but from a legal perspective. Chauvin, to me, that's murder. Now, what degree it is depends on the law in Minnesota. We'll see. The two dudes holding them down, that's a different situation. I think I could see them getting convicted or charged with aiding and abetting a murder. I'm surprised they charged the dude that didn't do anything. Because even though, like, watching him not do anything was very disturbing, and honestly, in some ways, as disturbing as the guy who did it, from a criminal standpoint, he didn't do an act. And that makes me wonder if they will be able to convict him. We'll have to wait and see. But it did seem like the city wanted all those guys charged, and it needed to happen just to quell everything.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we don't, as citizens, we don't understand the law, right?
Yes.
But like, what we understood was, if I had done this, I wouldn't get a chance to go home to my family. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think there was a sense of, wait a minute, man, these guys got to go home and eat dinner with their family and their kids. And, you know, they got to go watch a movie and like, wait a minute, that doesn't happen in real life. And I think, and I don't know the law, but if you do this Tuesday, if you somehow detain these four individuals Tuesday, you stop the protests to that degree. I think you pull a lot of things back. Because a lot of that anger was, these guys are still on the street somewhere.
You know? Yeah.
And I think
I'd be interested in the prosecutor's office. Because again, a lot of people don't know the law. So I think they think that the mayor, for instance, can charge those guys, and he cannot. I mean, they think the governor can, and he cannot. Yeah. I mean, the attorney general has to get the case referred to him before he can even do anything. It's really in these situations, first, it's the county prosecutor and the local police. And part of the problem is, how does the local police investigate itself, right? I mean, that I would argue that states should immediately, anytime an officer has potential criminal conduct, they should create, and some states have done this, a task force that takes the investigation from the local police department. Because it just doesn't work when a police department investigates itself. But a lot of people have righteous anger at the wrong people. You know, again, like that mayor, I want to ask you about the mayor. He looks like he's like 20. I mean, what are people's thoughts of him? Because when I see him speak, I actually feel like he's trying to do a good job, but I've also seen like people yelling at him. And what's the situation with him?
Jacob Frey had an extremely high approval rating going into this. I mean, he was viewed as not just a likable, I think, mayor, but I think also someone who knows what his future, you know, might hold, you know, who knows if he's going to higher office at some point. He just, there were no marks against him. And I think most people thought, this is a guy who can handle anything that comes at him. I think the challenge with any of this is, like, it's enough to be dealing with a pandemic. It's enough to be dealing with the economic fallout of that. And then you throw this at anybody. So I think now people are looking for kind of what's next. And I think that's where, you know, anybody who's an official in this city, a lot of people are saying the right things, but what's the right answer? You know, I don't know, but I think that's what a lot of these guys are trying to figure out.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's a lot of times that the right answer is not going to be something that really people want to hear. you know, the Breonna Taylor situation in Louisville is one of these things that I don't think they're going to be able to charge these three police officers criminally. I just don't. I mean, it's a tragedy. It's a terrible situation. There was incompetence that led to it. You know, the warrant had the wrong house, and there's a lot of incompetence. But when you talk about criminally charging these officers, I suspect, and I could be wrong, I don't know all the facts, so I'm not going to say whether they should be charged, but I suspect there's a very good chance they're not going to get charged. And I suspect legally that might end up being the right decision, and it's not going to feel right. You know what I mean? It's just not going to feel right. And that's what makes these situations so hard, because if I was Breonna Taylor's family, Myron, I'd be furious. I mean, I'd be livid. She's in bed. They come in. They don't knock. They come in the middle of the night on a drug case. Why are you coming in the middle of the night, right? Yeah. And then the warrant is wrong, and they may have been looking for a person who was already in jail, and, like, there's all this stuff. But at the end of the day, these officers are just doing what their boss told them to do. And they come in and somebody shoots at them. And, like, you know, it's just one of these things. And I sometimes really terrible situations don't give us the result that feels right. And that's hard.
Well, I think that's the fear here is, like, I think, you know, these officers being charged, Derek Chauvin being in jail right now. All of that, I think, is a first step. I tell you what, man, if these trials happen and these guys are acquitted, get out of the city.
Yeah, no kidding.
I mean,
how could somebody acquit Derek Chauvin? I mean, the other guys, it's going to be tougher, but Derek Chauvin, like, he's right there. Like, how could they acquit him?
But I think what, like, African Americans, not just here, but around the country, you know, are wrestling with the Breonna Taylor case, with all these cases. We're like, why is it always complicated with us?
That's,
like, how come when something happens to us, you got to not only cross your T's and dot your I's, but you got to do 15 other things before someone gets in trouble? Whereas when the situations are reversed and we're accused of being guilty of a crime, you don't see all these different hoops you got to jump through. It's pretty direct, you know? So I think that's what's really fueling some of the frustration. But I tell you what, man, I don't know how long it's going to take to get to trial. If there will be trials, will they plea? I don't know the details of that. But I know that people here are bracing for what they feel like is these guys, all of them, somehow getting off. And if that happens, man, I'm telling you, get out of this city, because it's not going to be like 2 weeks ago. It's going to be the worst of 2 weeks ago for a month, because they'll burn this thing down, you know?
You know, that's a really good point. That's a really good way of putting it, saying, why does it always have to be so many more hoops? And I can understand why people would feel that way. I do. Okay, so, you know, you mentioned that the next question is, what's next, right? And, you know, on Countdown to Kickoff, it was first me, you, and we'll talk about that football in a little bit. It's me, you, and Dan Orlovsky. Now it's me, you, and Jeff. And what's been interesting is, all three of you guys, especially Dan and Jeff, but you as well, I am a lot more interested in politics than you guys are. But I have watched over the course of this show, I've watched the three of you, especially Dan and Jeff, become much more interested than you were when I tried to talk about it before. You remember we'd sit in that studio, especially with Dan, and I'd try to talk, and Dan would just be like, God, shut up about all this stuff. And now he's writing me, asking me what I think about some of this stuff legally. But what's next is interesting to me. And this, and when I saw the story come out yesterday that you're all city council basically passed a veto proof majority to defund the police, the politician in me says, please don't use that as a slogan, because that ain't a winning slogan. But I learned during the Kaepernick thing, it ain't my choice to decide what people's slogans are. They get to decide themselves. But what does that mean to you? And what are you hearing that means they want to do in Minneapolis?
I know a lot of really smart people throughout this city. And I know people, you know, the mayor of St. Paul, who's been on a lot of shows, first African American of in St. Paul's history. It's one of my best friends, Melvin Carter. I know people on the ground who are organizing this campaign to defund the police. So I know a lot of smart people in the city who are reacting to it. And the consensus is, I need more information. I would say. I think the consensus is, I believe that there needs to be some reform, radical reform, because in this city, man, the history here is not good, man. Like, it's not like, you know, this happened to George Floyd and people were shocked. It's like, again, like another thing happening involving this department. So I think there are a lot of questions and concerns, but I would say, myself included, it's the question of how does that work? You know, the commitment really was by that group of council members to study the issue over the next year, which happens to be their reelection year. Yeah. And I don't want to get all political, but like, let's see what happens between that commitment and a year from now. And I think a lot of people here are going, you know, what does it mean? You got a lot of people who are scared. I mean, if you read some of the comments on the stories about it, it's like, if you think I'm staying in this city, you got another thing coming. It just feels, man, like everybody's so confused and not really sure how to take this energy that's clearly there and turn it into something productive.
Yeah.
Like, I think
that's a hard thing to do. And that's a hard thing to do. I mean, people don't like to hear this, but making policy is hard. Like, it's easy to, it's not easy to be upset. People have a reason to be upset. I don't want to minimize that, but it is hard to make policy. Cause I could sit here when I was in law school, my strength was, Myron, whatever it is that you, and this actually serves me well in Sports Talk Radio, whatever it is that you say, my strength was, I could tell you why you're wrong. Like, that was like, I used to win competitions at literally just doing that. Yeah. But when it comes to policy on this stuff, there are no easy answers. I mean, there is one easy answer. Stop killing Black people. I mean, that's an easy answer.
That'd be the request.
But beyond that, it's hard. So, you know, Camden, New Jersey did something a few years back that I think you're going to hear a lot more about, which is basically they just took apart the police department. They said, we're going to do this completely different. We're going to structure it different. We're going to rehire. They fired everybody, but gave the option of rehiring everybody. They decided to do policing in a different way, and they've had a lot of success. Now, is that transferable? I don't know, but I think you're going to start to hear a lot more about Camden, New Jersey, because that really is, I think, the model that a lot of these people are trying to think about doing.
Yeah, and the conversation here is, can we lead the way? I think a lot of people are talking about, can Minneapolis lead the way in terms of, excuse me, a new model of community policing? I think what a lot of people wonder is, as you implement a new model, there are always missteps, right?
Yeah.
Like, you don't always want to be the guinea pig.
You want to be second or third.
Yeah.
Like, but you're not hearing people, Myron, you're not hearing people argue we don't need police. You're not hearing that, are you?
Oh, that is the argument. I mean, so the vote, the what the members promised was to abolish the police department.
But they don't, but I understand they said that, but they're not saying we will have no police, are they?
That's what we're all trying to figure out.
Okay, they can't believe that. I mean, they cannot believe that, can they?
Well, I can tell you that the group leading the charge, that was their request to these council members.
See, that's insanity, though. That's insanity, isn't it?
But again, like, there's defund, there's dismantle, there are all these words. And the group that led the charge on the ground was talking about moving toward a complete community policing model. These council members, what they agreed to when they showed up at this rally yesterday was to work toward abolishing the police department. Now, the mayor, who they asked on Friday.
I saw that, yeah.
They said, hey, will you agree? He said, I won't agree to that. But the city officials who agreed to this also didn't relay a plan. But Lisa Bender, who is the city council president, did go on, I believe, Good Morning America and say, yes, I can envision a community without police. And Matt, I don't know what any of this means in the moment. I don't know where we go from here, but there is certainly a group of people here who are saying a community without police.
I mean, look, everybody can believe whatever they want. I community policing does not mean that the community polices itself. That's not what that means. That means, I mean, I actually did a college research project on community policing because Richmond, Virginia, Bill Clinton was really big into community policing back in the day. And the idea of community policing is rather than spending all your time as an outside force trying to keep the community down, you engage in the community. And like you spend a lot of your time walking streets, meeting people, learning the names of everybody on the idea being you're less likely to have negative interactions when people know each other, right? Some people think that works, some people it doesn't. I think most studies suggest there's some success there, but it doesn't mean that the community just has no police and that everybody just sits there and like, I don't know of any society in the world that does that. So if someone is really arguing that, I'm sure there are smart people. I would love to hear that argument because I don't know what it would be.
But I think here that's the confusion, right? I think you have, here's what you have. You got the group of people who are saying massive radical reform is necessary now, right? Like changes need to be implemented now. We've had too many situations and George Floyd was sort of the peak of this. Hey, enough is enough. Things need to change. And we're open to any ideas that might be out there as to how you change things. There's another group, I think, that's saying, let's take some of the power away from local police, put it in the hands of the community, take some of the funding away from police, invest in the community. But this group that is leading the charge in terms of what you witnessed with these council members, that is a group talking about a community without police. Now, here's what I've tried to do on this issue and every other issue. And I'm just trying to be better about this in general. I'm trying to be smart about not speaking on things that I haven't researched, that I don't understand. Mm-hmm. And I can admit, I don't understand these ideas on community policing, but I do know a bunch of people who have studied these things and are organizers, and they swear that these are possibilities, right? I just don't know how we get from today to a year from now when they're going to study these issues. I don't know if this is emotion of the moment. I don't know, but I think we're a long way from what some people want, you know, in terms of what change looks like for them. But it's part of the chaos of this, man. I mean,
I'm sure.
Hey, people go strip it all down, man. Build from scratch. That's easier said than done.
Yeah. I think you're going to hear a lot about Camden, New Jersey. I mean, I would suggest for anybody listening to this, and let me just say, I'm not an expert on Camden, New Jersey. When I studied community policing, it was in Richmond, Virginia, 20 plus years ago. And I'm sure the ideas behind it have advanced quite a bit. But everybody points to Camden, New Jersey, which was this, from what I understand, had this horrible crime rate. In 2017, they redid it. And the early signs are that it's positive. I don't know. I mean, it's what I'm going to spend time, but I guarantee you all of you listening to this are going to hear a lot about Camden, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. With that said, you're the grown-up of the two of us. I like you saying I don't speak on what I don't know. I'm going to say one thing on something I don't know. There's no scenario I can see where you can't have police. I just can't see how that would work, but we'll see.
Well, and that's why I think yesterday was such a big moment, because you had a group of officials at a major city saying, you know, we're going to get there. Now, here was the thing. Nobody had a plan for it. Like, no one had a concrete plan for it. So you don't know. Like, you don't.
Well, I'm going to become Superman. I just don't have a plan for making it happen yet, Myron.
It's wild up here. I mean, people are trying to wrestle with that, man, and figure it out.
It should be interesting. Minnesota is going to be, you guys are going to be on the forefront of a lot of things, I think, in part because Minnesota was the state that Hillary won by the smallest margin. Meaning if you're Donald Trump and you're looking at the map and you're saying, where can I win? Because there's a lot of Trump states that are up for grabs and there aren't a lot of Hillary states that are up for grabs. And Minnesota is one. So I think you're going to see Trump have a big presence in Minnesota, which I don't think helps, by the way. But I think you all are going to see, this is just my prediction, Trump sees Minnesota as a place he can go win because he's probably going to lose Arizona in a couple places that he won last time. And I think he sees himself going to Minnesota. And I think he's going, what you all don't need is what I think is going to happen, which is I think Minnesota is going to become the political battleground of America over the next 5 or 6 months.
I would say Minnesota right now in the wake of George Floyd has already felt like, and I'm not, you know, I'm not going to talk politics on a deep level, but it already feels like a political battleground in some regards. It just, it's impossible to really describe what's happened over the last 2 weeks and how has become the center of the country in so many different ways, you know, and like,
hasn't been that big since what, Prince and Kirby Puckett, right? Like, man, that's not, the last time.
Prince, that's it. Prince and Kirby Puckett, man. This is a different deal. But we just become, I feel like, everyone looking to Minneapolis going, we'll see what happens there, and that will inform decisions elsewhere. And that's not something you're accustomed to Minneapolis really being sort of at the forefront of anything.
We'll switch gears for a second. Let's you and I go to the NFL. So I got asked to do that NFL show 2 weeks before the opening
game. I remember.
And were you already
– a different show, I think, right?
Well, I was supposed to do the college football wrap-up show, and I couldn't do it because of my UK responsibilities, and they called me the next day. And so I was bummed. I was like, I've just given up my chance to do ESPN. And then they called me the next day, and they go, how about the NFL pregame show? And I was like – and my agent goes, Matt, you got to do it. And I said, I don't know anything about the NFL. Like, I know like 20 quarterbacks, 10 coaches. That's probably it. And he was like, we'll learn. And it was right when KS Bar was opening. And I just sit down there during the construction and just read the Football Outsiders book. And I can now say, and Myron knows, those first few weeks, man, I was just winging it. So you and Dan Orlovsky, I was just like, the New England Patriots, Tom Brady, man, he's good. Right, Dan? And then just throw it to you all and let you do your thing.
I will say though, man, I think we all got better together. I mean, those first couple of shows were just rough, trying to figure out everything, man. But it's been cool to watch Dan and what he's become. Because, I mean, we were the first people who really worked with him at ESPN. Like, he had just gone from, like, the Twitter analyst to live radio. So it was fun, though, man. It was fun to just do it. You know, I never thought I'd be on an NFL pregame show. I cover college basketball. What do they need?
I certainly did not think I would be on an NFL pregame show.
But it was cool. It's been cool, man, to do it.
You know, do you remember the second week when we were all up there and I threw my headphones down and stormed out? Do you remember that?
I remember thinking in that moment, in my mind, I was like, is this going to work? You know, I was like, is this going to work? Like, are we all coming back for week three? Cause this is a bit.
Well, more. I was only mad at myself. No, I mean, I wasn't mad at anybody else. It was just, you know, ESPN has these stupid rules about you can't say welcome back. And like, I would say it every time. And every time they'd get in my ear and go, Matt, you can't say welcome back. We're always here. We never leave. Remember that. No welcome backs, no coming up, you know? And like, and they, you know, they have this rule, Myron, you can say next or coming up, but you can't say we'll be back or welcome back. Now, to me, I love the folks at ESPN, but that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. But I just couldn't get it out of my head. It would drive me crazy, and it would affect the entire segment because I'd just be thinking, please don't say welcome back. Please don't say welcome back.
I remember, man, there were some tense moments in that studio, man. Some tense moments in the studio. But we figured it out, and you figured it out, and you got really good at it. And I think now it just kind of flows. You know, I thought when Jeff Schwartz came in, like, okay, how's that going to – because it took us a while to get that chemistry with Dan.
Yeah.
And then Jeff kind of jumped in, and it's been seamless.
Dan Orlovsky, by the way, is like the nicest guy. I mean, he really is because, you know, we've watched him explode. Like, I remember the first week sitting there in Bristol with him. You weren't there. It was just me and him, and you were on remote. And I was like, man, I don't know about this dude. He's way too pretty. And like, you know, I just don't, he was dressed like a catalog ad that day. And I'm wearing a hoodie and shorts and like, you know, and he has ended up being, I mean, still to this day, the dude could end up on Monday Night Football.
Yeah.
But if you or I text him, he texts back immediately. Like when my dad was sick, he checked in every couple of days. He's just a good person.
Yeah, man. It's been fun to watch his rise. And it's amazing. He's created a network of ex-NFL guys who are now trying to prove they're sort of analysts on Twitter, you know, and turn that into a gig, you know. And Dan was the first one to do that. So it's been awesome, man. I hope he gets whatever he wants, but even to see him being a top analyst and, you know,
but you called it. You knew quickly. I remember like week three or four, you said to me, we ain't going to have this guy very long. And that was pretty clear.
I know, I can tell, you know, like you could see that they put him in the right spot. And once he got comfortable, you could tell he could be really
good. This is an example of how nice he is. Like, I have no, like, I have nothing to do with his success, but he acts like it. Like, he'll say that. Like, he'll say that in meetings with ESPN people. You know, what really got me, he has told, I've had multiple ESPN executives tell me that he has said to them, I got better once Matt told me X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
Which is really nice. He doesn't need to do that. Like, most people would just say they got better. They wouldn't give anyone any credit. And the fact that he does, I really appreciate.
Yeah, no, I think you helped me too, man. I think, and that's what I always tell people, you know, I get all these young people who, they made me find out I work for ESPN, and their first thing is like, how do I get to become like Stephen A. Smith or something? Like,
yeah.
And I keep telling people, like, Stephen A. Smith ain't old, man. He ain't going anywhere. He's gonna be there, you know? Like, but they all want to shoot to the moon. And I'm like, you know what? You find a comfortable role and you find a place where you can excel and you could do that for a long time.
Yeah.
And I felt like with us, you driving, Dan being the smart NFL guy, me being hot take guy or you know, whatever I had to be that day, it would work. And I think you did a great job with Dan, because Dan, remember those first couple shows, was just analyst. Hey, here's, it was like he was trying to do TV on the radio.
Yes.
But then we got him into dialogue and challenged him. So when I watch him on Get Up now, I'm like, that dude didn't exist.
No, he didn't.
When we started the show, you know, he's really evolved.
Well, you know, people who listen to this podcast and have never listened to me on that show, I actually think they wouldn't necessarily totally realize it's the same person. Because, so to me, if you get me talking about college sports or politics or my life, I'll just be Mr. Hot Take, because I know that I know more information than most people, so I can do it. But I know with the NFL, most of the people I'm debating know more about it than I do. So I realized that my role on that is kind of dishing the rock. Like, it's, I don't need to be Jordan. I actually need to be Stockton on this. And I've had people say to me, friends go, you are completely different on that. And it wasn't honestly until this year with Jeff that I started realizing how I could inject my personality into it. Mm-hmm. But it's a completely different role, because nobody on ESPN Radio wants to hear me talk about, except that day you and I talked about Mountain Holler. Not too many people want to hear me talk about what movie I went and saw. So you have to, you're exactly right. You have to figure out the role that works for you in that particular situation.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I always tell people I'm not comfortable driving shows, and people will say, oh, that's something.
That's hard, man. It's hard.
But, and people always tell me, oh, you should learn to do it. And I'm like, for what? I know my role. I know I'm going to be better. If I'm seated next to you, you know, that I'm better in that. Like, I know myself. Like, I know where I excel. So I think once you find that, you just kind of lock in. And I think that's why the show really works.
I do feel like one day you and I are going to do a show together. I just feel like. I feel like it's coming at some point.
How about that first show we ever did? How about that first show we ever did where I got locked out of my studio?
That's right. You were like at Georgia State, weren't you? And you got locked out and you made me go 10 minutes on my own on national radio. And I'm so terrible at that. And you made me do that. I just had to sit there and talk. And the subject was like, wrestling and baseball. Like, I was like, man, you got to do something for me here. And you're like locked out, knocking on the door.
I just remember when I checked back in, I heard like Arn Anderson or Ric Flair or somebody you were talking about.
I just went back to when I knew how to talk. I literally think we were supposed to talk like Mike Trout, and I knew nothing about it. And I was like, you know what? I'm just switching and talking about wrestling, because I know I could do that for 10 minutes. Let me ask you about on the NFL, since we're going to be starting this back up in a few months. Do you buy that the whole Roger Goodell, now you all could do whatever you want? I'm washed in the blood of the Lamb, and I forgive everyone.
Man, I'd love to hear from owners You know, I think that's the next group that I want to hear from. I know Roger is their sort of spokesperson, but I want to hear owners echo his words directly before I can get behind this idea that it's just going to be acceptable. I think, I don't know how he can go back. Like, I don't know how you make a statement like that, and then if people protest, you somehow condemn them. But I also can't ignore that we spent 4 years, you know, attacking individuals who were trying to peacefully protest. And now it's cool again, or now it's okay. So I kind of got to see it to believe it. But for me, I'd love to hear Jerry Jones talk about it. I'd love to hear some of these owners come forward and say, yeah, what Roger Goodell said, I'm with him. Because I don't know, is there a consensus? Is it half the league, 90% of the league back that statement? I don't know. But I'll be interested to see what happens, because I think it's not just NFL. The whole sports world is going to protest, right? But I think everyone in the NFL will kneel. And it'll just
well, I had Randall Cobb. I mean, people are going to hear this tomorrow, but I did an interview with Randall Cobb earlier today, and he basically said he was going to kneel. And Randall Cobb is not exactly like a, you know, social justice warrior. If he's kneeling, they're all kneeling. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like that's coming. And I, you know, do you, we had a text chain with me, you, Jeff, and Dan, where I said, look, this just shows how much the country's moved. Cause the NFL, they go where the majority of white people go. The NBA has a largely African-American population of fans, mm-hmm. et cetera. Baseball is completely a different thing. The NFL is, what do the majority of white people think? That's what we think. And 3 years ago, they clearly thought the majority of white people do not want Colin Kaepernick kneeling. And maybe they were right. I don't know. Now, don't you think the fact they flipped that position says they believe that's what the majority of white people have flipped?
I think that's a big component of it. But I think that video did matter, that you had Mahomes and Deshaun Watson, because if you're Goodell, you see everyone on that video.
It's a future.
Brady, yeah, that's your future's black. And it's not just young and black. Your future is bold and black. Like, I think Mahomes being in that video and saying Black Lives Matter is a powerful thing. Knowing that the face of this league, the guy who just won a Super Bowl, youngest ever to win a Super Bowl, a league MVP, and a Super Bowl MVP, he's saying, I'm going to carry that torch forward. You got to respond to that. So I think it was a combination of America changing and feeling like things are acceptable today that weren't acceptable 4 weeks ago. But I think it was also these young guys in our league, they're coming and they're not going to be quiet. They're not going to be silent. So we got to respond to that.
I think you're right. But also Mitt Romney was in a Black Lives Matter protest yesterday. I mean, think about that for a minute. I mean, think about what, like, that's unfathomable 6 months ago. Yeah. I mean, it's Mark Stoops walked downtown in Lexington, Kentucky, and had a Black Lives Matter shirt on, put his whole team in Black Lives Matter t-shirts. And there was a little pushback, but there wasn't a lot. I mean, yeah. I know you don't know these places, but I'll just say this because I haven't gotten a chance to say it anywhere else. I grew up in Middlesboro, Corbin, Harlan, Hazard, Manchester, Pikeville, these small towns with majority white populations, and in some cases like Corbin, all white populations, are having Black Lives Matter rallies where hundreds of people are showing up, mm-hmm. and like it's not becoming something wild of people angry. I can't tell you, I'm happy about it, but I can't tell you how much that blows my mind. Yeah, I think it's changed, man. I just do.
I hope it's changed. So all I can do is hope, man. I've never seen anything like this, and I'm with you. The response, like I measure what people like you say, or people who I know have grown up in different parts of the country, and they're all saying what you said. I come from a place where you never would imagine this, right? And it's just so explosive. All from this, what happened in Minneapolis, I just hope we can sustain this energy. And I just hope when we get our first kickoff that we don't suddenly forget everything that's happening right now. And I don't know, I expect Roger to kneel. I mean, to me, his statement says,
I'm going really? To kneel. That would be amazing. I mean,
I think he will.
You think, I want to say one more thing about the towns. Corbin, Kentucky, Myron, in 1919 in Corbin, the towns folks rounded up every black person in the city, put them in a train and sent them away and said, don't come back. Wow. And there were a lot of black people that lived there then. Fast forward to when I was in high school in the mid-1990s, most of my basketball teammates, about half were black. You didn't stop in Corbin and eat. You did not. You kept going. You knew that Corbin was the place that really wasn't cool. And the one time we did it, it was very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
The fact that they have that rally in Corbin with that history and that it goes well and seemed to be pretty well appreciated by the town. I mean, I'm an optimist. You know, Bomani gets on me all the time. He always says you're too optimistic. Okay, I'm an optimist, but that's pretty optimistic to me. Do you think Kaepernick gets on a roster this fall?
I don't think so. I don't think so. Because I think now more than anything, the NFL owners can point to, see, we're an ally now. I mean, I think that'll be the messaging.
What if the players demand it like they did in that video? I mean, what if the Mahomes of the world say, you guys are full of shit unless you put him on a roster because I know he's better than X. And they're right. He's better than somebody on these rosters.
I don't know, man. His name, and we talked about this, his name wasn't mentioned in any statement attached
That's
to
true.
What the NFL said. And I don't know. I mean, you talked about the legal elements. There could be something there. But for me, if you're going to make this announcement, you've got to say his name, right? You got to say, hey, we apologize to Colin Kaepernick. That hasn't happened. So I don't know that I'm getting optimistic to the point where I think he gets a job. And here's the other question, Matt. If you give him a job, are you accused of pandering? Are you guilty of just pandering? What are you really invested in Colin Kaepernick and his mission and his plight if you give him a job? Or are you bringing him in because it's going to be good for the attention you're going to get?
Actually, I don't like that question, Myron, because that was the question. Okay, so when affirmative action became, and whatever people think of affirmative action now, it's indisputable that when it happened, when it was initially put into place, it was needed. And when that first set of people had success in affirmative action, you could easily have said, these schools, well, they're just pandering by bringing these people in. Well, you know what? We need, whether it's pandering or not, it was necessary for the time. You know, listen, I'm not saying they should make Kaepernick a starter, but I don't think anyone in their right minds believes he's not one of the 96 best quarterbacks in America.
Of course.
And if nothing else, he should have a chance to show that he's one of the 96 best quarterbacks. And if that's pandering, sometimes you need pandering.
But I think what you just said is my concern. Will he get a legitimate chance to really make a roster, affect the roster, possibly be a starter, as opposed to being some sideshow you bring in because you want to parade him around? I mean, that to me, I mean, I think that's how he felt in that workout. You know, the whole controversy with that workout.
But shouldn't we trust him? Shouldn't we trust him to decide if he's getting a fair shot? Like, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, if he doesn't believe he's getting a fair shot, presumably he won't even do it. And then it is what it is.
I feel like a fair shot is Colin Kaepernick having the opportunity to choose, you know, from a multitude of opportunities, as opposed to, hey, Minnesota Vikings, George Floyd happened here. You should go out and get Colin Kaepernick, which is what a lot of people have written. Like, a lot of people in our world have written, the Vikings should sign Colin Kaepernick. Now is the time. So I think that's the kind of thing that worries me. If he gets an opportunity and gets to pick and choose, which is what he's earned, I would understand that. I want to see him in the league, man. I want to see him in the league.
Before we finish, let's talk a little college basketball. You really like Cal, don't you?
Yeah, I think Cal – I don't know if, like, if you've obviously followed what he's been doing, but Cal strikes me as being genuine. I mean, I was on a call where he's talking about an internship program for minorities. Here's the thing I always respected about Cal. When I did the first story on Cal and I went up to his office manager, African-American, Dwayne, African-American in sports information. Two assistants, African-American. His trainer was African-American. His strength coach was African-American. I mean, the people around him, you can see that Cal is someone who has given people opportunities who don't look like him. And I've talked to people who know Cal and have worked with Cal over the years, and they've said, yeah, he's extremely comfortable around African-Americans, around people who don't necessarily look like him. And I think you combine that with him being a guy who says, yeah, you can come to Kentucky, and if you can fulfill your dream after a year, go for it. You have to respect that. But I think what he's doing now, you know, canceling coffee with Cal to put his energy toward these conversations, Cal can lead this thing. I mean, Cal can take college basketball and everything there and put together the kind of effort that affects change. And I think he's trying to do that, and I respect that.
What does college basketball look like in 3 years? I mean, you're starting to hear that maybe they won't do away with the one and done because this G League thing might be the way that they get around it. I've never totally understood why the NBA wants to go back to the one and done, because it didn't really work for them. Most people failed. Yeah. This G League thing might actually be what they do instead. Is that where you think this is headed?
I think there's a chance. I mean, I think where college basketball is headed is that we'll lose the top 10 to 15 kids every year. I think that's 3 years from now. The top 10 recruits in America, high school kids, one way or the other, won't play college basketball, and everyone else will. I'm curious to see, man, like, are we going to be able to watch the G League thing on TV? Is it going to be a bigger deal culturally? I don't know the answer to that. Are you going to get a big shoe deal? Like, I'm interested to see the buzz around this G League showcase, but I think we'll miss the top 10 to 15 kids, and then college basketball will keep going because you still have the tournament. Like, that's what you can't replace.
Can't replicate.
The build up to the tournament is untouchable.
I we'll see. Okay, so to me, what would crush college basketball, get rid of the one and done and put in a G League minor league system that's for real, that you invest a lot of money into so that you can pay 100 players. I don't think they're going to do that. That's just you're just flushing money down the toilet if you do that, in my opinion. I'm not sure the G League as it's currently, like what they're talking about with these dudes, maybe they just got the wrong class. Maybe they should have waited till Emoji Bates or whatever came by. But who cared? Like, I mean, in all honesty, who wants to see these guys? Like, no offense to them. I mean, I'm sure they're going to be good. But do you think America was ready to see LeBron, right? America was ready to see Zion. On a lower level, they were ready to see Anthony Davis. I'm not sure that anybody's really caring about these dudes right now. So I kind of feel like this will be a huge dud in terms of anyone caring about it. And I don't really understand why the NBA is investing this money that they won't see any return on. So I just don't know that that'll continue, but we'll see.
I think, man, I don't know how much buzz they'll create, but I do think how college basketball fights is with name, image, and likeness, you know, and how, you know, if you can sell kids on financial opportunities, like your Kentuckys and Dukes, you're going to have an advantage, obviously.
If they do that, though, won't some of these dudes come to college? I mean, let's just take Zion for a second. I continue to make the argument that Zion, Duke was a positive for him. Zion came into the league worth substantially more from going to Duke than if he had gone to a G League thing, or maybe even if he had gone to a one and done or to a, you know, none and done, like gone straight to the NBA. He was worth more because of that year at Duke, wasn't he?
Oh, 100%. I mean, the shoe, broken shoe thing clearly changed college basketball. But you got the NCAA fighting against shoe companies. The NCAA wants shoe companies away from the sport, which isn't going to help anybody. I'm curious if your Zion Williamson comes to college with a shoe deal. Like, is that the future? Where instead of waiting until after you're drafted, guys come in and, hey, Nike gave Amani Bates $10 million. He's going to Kentucky, but you know that he's already got this big shoe deal. Like, I wonder if that's the future. Guys trying to get ahead of things. But
I would have no problem with that.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, would you?
No, I mean, if Zion had been given $20 million coming into college, and knowing like what we know now, if you would find out Zion signed a $20 million deal out of high school, would that have been crazy?
No.
With all the attention he got?
But just also think about, I say this all the time, that game in the Champions Classic where Duke beat Kentucky by like 40 and Zion Williamson announced himself to the world. That game made him $10 million, in all honesty, because it said to everyone, oh, who's this guy? And the whole year became about that. If that game occurs against the New Brunswick All-Stars in the G League, it ain't the same thing. It had to be Duke, Kentucky in the Champions Classic.
Yeah, and I think if you can make more money in college, again, while you're in college, that'll be the challenge to that G League. Because I think a lot of these guys – listen, man, $500,000, for anybody, that's a lot of money. For a 17-year-old who's like, I don't want to study anymore. I'll take it. You know, that's tempting.
Last thing, what are you hearing about? We always talk about college football. What are you hearing about college basketball? Starting on time? Like, what are you hearing the basketball folks say?
We're waiting on college football. I think everybody feels that I've talked to – that if college football gets off the ground, college basketball will be fine. The great fear is if college football can't get off the ground or gets off the ground and somehow stops.
That's worse.
We're not going to have college basketball. So I think that to me is the thing. A lot of coaches I've talked to are concerned about these schools that are starting in August, ending classes in November, you know. They don't want to be left out to dry when it's time for college basketball. But I think a lot of coaches I know have said, if we get football, we'll get basketball. Now, I don't know when we'll get basketball. Will they move the season? I don't know.
Matt's audio cuts off here, but he ends the show by asking Myron about the schools that may participate in college sports this year.
Or will it just be the richer schools play? Because the Power Five schools are going to play, right? I think they have the best chance to play. But will you see East Tennessee State? That'll be the question. But I think they go for it. I think you're going to take what you can get if you're the NCAA and you get in that situation. So whoever's available, you're going to round them up. But we've never seen anything like this, man. I just hope college football gets off the ground because that means life is coming back to normal, not just with sports, but everything else.